Now it is time for the futures.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks. Welcome to a live show from KSCO Studios in beautiful Santa Cruz. Another sunny day today, beautiful spring day. It's wonderful to be here.
Perfect day to ride a bike.
Yes, and our guests who are coming on for the second hour are here already having ridden their bikes.
We'll introduce them.
Well, we could. Do you want to break tradition
right,
and just say
Hi? We're actually going to interview these guys in the second hour when we talk about a few different alternative transportation inventions, devices, and policies for the local area here. We're going to talk about bike trails. We're going to talk about a fancy new bicycle that can bring a lot of joy to local riders.
You just say hi, and then we'll grab again.
We have Karina McFarland and Ryan Sarnatano. We're going to be talking about bikes in the second hour.
That's right.
Yeah,
so welcome, you guys, and you get to listen to our show for the first hour.
Yay.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Make sure that you pull the mics close to your face if you're going to talk.
There you go. That's
okay.
Your talk.
Like
that's
good.
Cool. All right.
Okay.
We're listening.
Fantastic. All right. So with that as a little precursor, where do you want to begin in the future?
Well, first of all, we got to remember that the Chinese spacecraft crashed. Right?
That's
finally
right.
Went back to it. We were a little worried that it might hit people, but not that much.
Not that much.
But
yeah,
the Chinese space station.
Only one person in history has ever been hit by falling space debris that we know of.
That's right. The size of a school bus.
The Tiangong 1.
Right. It entered the Earth's atmosphere about 5:16 Pacific time on Sunday, and it scattered its pieces over the South Pacific Ocean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were probably looking up down in Fiji going, what's that fire in the sky?
We do have our friends in Fiji, you know. Knowing Kelly, who's been on the show before, she would have seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was safe.
Oh, and if anybody would have gotten hit by debris, it would have been Kelly.
That's right. She has that special
that magnetic attraction.
Je ne sais quoi, that somehow creates that kind of experience.
Right.
Yeah. Nothing to worry about anymore on that front, which is really cool.
Yes, no disasters to be reported. There was a really interesting light show for those few people in the vicinity who could look up and see it.
Now, if we had KSCO TV, I'd show you this picture. It's really awesome. The radar is what is used to track objects coming in from space. You aim a radar up and you can get really cool shots. And the radar systems around the world caught some beautiful shots of the craft re-entering the atmosphere and beginning to turn white hot as it disintegrated.
Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful disintegration art, I might say.
Right, and totally unplanned, spontaneous disintegration art of the descent of the Heavenly Palace.
Right.
That's the translation of Tiangong.
And in the future, we've got to consider about what are we going to do about other space junk that's out there and stuff like that. So we wanted to mention a couple of things about how NASA, for example, can save us from asteroid impacts. They've got a couple of new plans for that. There's an actual program to eliminate space junk that's going to be launched next week, I believe, on a SpaceX supply ship.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
So are they going to collect space junk? Are they going to jettison it towards the sun? What do you know about it?
Well, European engineers have developed a small satellite that hitches a ride to the International Space Station aboard a SpaceX supply ship. And it's a first-of-a-kind of experiment to see if we can snare chunks of space junk.
I see.
Snare
it. We're going out butterfly hunting. We're going to catch it with the net.
We're going to tug it back to the Earth somehow.
Oh, really? I think that's the wrong direction for space junk.
No, it burns up in the atmosphere.
Oh, well.
Now, the atmosphere is really great for getting rid of junk. You know, it's like an incinerator.
Do we really want all that burnt stuff in the atmosphere? I thought we were already worried about global warming.
You're being extra eco, Mrs. Future.
you can never be too eco.
You think so? A few space junk molecules in the upper atmosphere? I don't know. That's pushing it. yes, even for Santa Cruz.
Coming from a Y chromosome who can't see garbage, I think that we should just really have a long-term debate about this.
Yeah, okay. But meanwhile, I got some other elements here to talk about. The crux of the mission is to prove that cleaning up space junk can be relatively inexpensive, because nets aren't that expensive.
I suppose the nets burn up in the atmosphere too.
Yeah. We want to learn as much as possible by trying it at least. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea, is that we're going to try to net some space junk and throw it in the atmosphere.
That's cool. So who's doing the space junk?
This is the European Space Agency project.
ESA? Okay. Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah, there's some Brits involved with this one. Because they have Surrey. Remember Surrey? University of Surrey? Surrey Space Center. Mm. It's a research they're very involved with this. It's called the Remove Debris Satellite. It will launch in a container on SpaceX. It says Monday. It could be up already. Hey. All right. Oh. It's there.
All right. The space cleanup has begun.
That's right. And the space debris spacecraft itself is 220 pounds.
Okay.
A mere 220 pounds or 100 kilos.
Compared to Tiangong. Right?
Yeah, right. Well, that was really serious space junk. Mm. So if it's up, they'll be unpacking it very soon, along with tons of equipment. In the next few weeks, we shall hear how successful it is.
I suppose this is a remote-controlled vehicle that's going to go collect all the space
junk.
It's not like something a space cowboy could ride, like a bucking bronco.
Well, it's a net. It has a harpoon on it as well.
Oh, got it. So it's not a cowboy.
Sound.
It's a
But I don't think you carry
Moby
a person
Dick
in
collector.
It. Right, and okay. not at 220 pounds, it's not going to be people safe. It's going to be definitely a remote-controlled robot ship.
Okay, let's go collect some space whales.
Yeah, that'll be good for space junk. It's not going to be much good for getting asteroids, though. Asteroids are a bigger space junk problem, if you call them junk, which I wouldn't.
Not if you know what's good for you.
Not if you think that, you know, they're listening.
I was going to say, yeah, everything's alive, right?
Yeah.
I think asteroids
some
have
way or
ears.
Another. Now, these asteroids, yeah. I mean,
ears are starting to burn.
They could put a dent in our whole species.
If they wanted to,
right.
If we couldn't get out of the way fast enough.
Well, look at what happened to the dinosaurs, right?
Right.
And that's
right.
Just one.
Well, what do you think they're going to do if they find out about our plans to deal with them and redirect them?
Well, I think we should try one on them and see if they react, if I like it.
What are we trying?
We're going to try another project. This is a NASA project. It's an American project. Have you ever seen those little radiometers that you put in the window? They look like a light bulb, but inside them is a little thing that rotates, and on one side is black and the other white.
Mm-hmm.
You ever seen those things? The little pinwheels,
like pinwheel.
The sun shines on them, and the sun absorbs on the black side, and the difference in the heat causes this little thing to spin as long as it's in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's kind of based on that idea. The idea is that we paint the asteroids, and if you paint it a black color, it absorbs the light, and it actually changes its trajectory.
I see. So you're going to
paint
it, it'll get warm. And then
You paint it on one side, you know, so one side is warmer than the other, and it causes it to rotate, and it moves a little bit in its path, and our computers can figure
out how to paint it white so we could see it better.
Well, white doesn't absorb the light.
No, but it reflects the light.
One would be if you paint both sides, one side black and the other side white, like our radiometers. We could spin it, maybe even put a generator on board because it's spinning, and you could create a little electric propulsion system that moves the whole thing.
You know what I think about all this?
What's that?
Listen
commercial
to the
time? All right. It's very good. All right. You're listening to the Dr. Future Show. We'll be back after a commercial break from our sponsors. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. This week, Zipline announces the world's fastest commercial drone. You know, drone delivery is speeding up with more and more companies coming online to do that sort of thing. You've heard of the Amazon delivery, of course. But Zipline is a California startup that we saw, I believe, about a year, 2 years ago now at a drone conference.
Here in Santa Cruz.
Yeah. And they were pioneering the idea of using drones for delivering medicines and
medical
other
supplies,
first
and
responder
organs, donated organs for surgery.
In Africa, through areas that had lousy roads.
Right.
You know, where you had to get something there, an emergency.
Yeah.
And they were very successful in Rwanda, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Now they want to bring their service to the United States. They figured out enough of it. Tanzania as well. They also worked in Tanzania.
So the company that we're talking about, Zipline, is coming to the United States after several years of building businesses everywhere else in the world, because as it turns out, the U.S. is going much slower than many other places in the implementation of drone delivery systems.
And what's unique about their drone approach is that instead of just using the quadcopter design, the VTOL aircraft approach that most people are using, they've created one that is more like a regular airplane. It has wings on it, making it much more effective in going longer distances.
Yeah, because the big issue that I remember them talking about when they were here at the California Drone Conference 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago now, is that the limitation of a drone flight is the battery life. And so most of the flights that they were able to make could only do 20-minute jumps before they had to change batteries. So they had to have re-battery charge stations where the drone would get to a charge station and then land and somebody would change the battery and then it could go another 20 minutes. And so they designed the vehicles to get the most out of that 20-minute battery life.
So they're hoping this fixed-wing aerial robot design will be speedier and cheaper in terms of battery usage and easier to maintain. And so far, so good. Of course, they're going up against Google. Google's got Project Wing. You heard about that? It's a secretive X-Lab project. No?
Yes, I do hear drone people talk about Project
Wing.
Well,
let's just say all I can tell you about that right now is that the pilot project is in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And they're using their drone to deliver pharmaceuticals, of course, and burritos.
That sounds
pretty sci-fi. Gives you a wide range of what's possible with this technology.
But no lattes?
Maybe tomorrow. I suggest you try that. You know, the pizza delivery, of course. We saw that in...
Ready Player One.
Ready Player One, right?
Oh, yeah. That was such an excellent movie.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that Spielberg was involved in that. They did a great job.
If you were at all a fan of gaming or video gaming, especially in the 80s and 90s, you'll love this film.
Yes, and this is not really a spoiler, but there is an homage to Snow Crash right at the beginning of the movie, because what do we know about the future? There are no jobs except for pizza delivery.
Yep, it's a great homage, and lots of drones, of course, and sadly, a little bit dysfunctional society. I would not want to live in one of those trailer parks. I much prefer the Santa Cruz trailer parks, actually, if I'm going to go for a trailer park.
That's right. Well, it may well be that living in vehicles is the future of small homes.
Do you think?
Absolutely.
Stacking trailers?
Well, stacking them is definitely the sci-fi element of it. But, you know, the trend towards tiny houses and looking around, hearing about people who are living in their houses, mobile houses is definitely the temporary solution that a lot of people have to embrace.
So Ready Player One shows you these dysfunctional ideas of the future of housing. that's not its really main point, though. The main element of it is that the virtual worlds are going to become more and more of a place we'll be hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not we use them for anything other than entertainment, well, I think it's going to be much more of an educational element of it than what they discussed in the film.
Oh, of course. The film is
a
story.
Yeah, it's a story of the gaming. And
it's a movie.
For that point of view, being able to visualize some of these scenes is just awesome.
Yeah.
Liked it in that part. Also, we have a link on our page to a local reviewer, Rob Aaron, who did an excellent job in getting some information out about that film as a movie review. We have that in our links page at drfutureshow.com/links.
Yes, we did enjoy Ready Player One.
Totally. Also in the news, there was a rare cosmic alignment that happened that revealed the most distant star we've ever seen.
Ooh, yes. This is more breaking headline news from the Hubble.
Yes. Yes, the Hubble Space Telescope has been in the news over the years for all the amazing discoveries that it's been capable of doing, looking at remote galaxies and deep field effect that we saw 20 years ago to show us that the universe is more larger than we even imagined.
That's right. The Hubble first came into my awareness when the deep field galaxies were first published, and the Hubble was pointed at the darkest place in the sky to see if there was anything there to see. And not only did they discover something, they discovered more galaxies than we even realized existed. And so our entire concept of how large the universe was grew exponentially.
Now, what's unique about this latest discovery is that it's not a galaxy that it discovered, but it's a star system.
It's a star.
Right.
Not a whole galaxy, just one star. It's inconceivable that some one element like that could be that far away. The star is 9 billion light years away.
9 billion. And you consider that the universe itself, as far as we know, is about 13.7 billion years old. That's pretty close to the beginning of it all. So we're looking literally at light coming from near the beginning of the universe itself,
well,
as we know
9
it.
9 billion years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is something that only the Hubble would be able to collect light. So,
and it can't collect light from every 9 billion year old star. It just happens that an anomaly allowed the Hubble to see a star because there's this new technology called gravitational lensing, where the gravity waves of the universe are measured, and it gives the scientists basically a telescope that allows them to see distant objects that are beyond the closer objects due to a tiny little shift in the measurements that reveals gravity from a different star. So when a star that is closer comes between us and this other star that's further away, the light of the closer star illuminates the farther star. So it's only because we had a star about the size of our sun pass between us and this other giant star that's 9 billion years old that we were able to see it.
Yeah, so this magnifying lensing effect just really came in handy for us to find this. Amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they said that the magnification is several thousand times.
Wow.
What the
really
normal
over
magnification
what we'd see.
Is. Yeah.
Gee, I wonder if they'll give us new ideas of creating more sensitive telescopes.
I'm sure they're working on it.
Well, good. Well, thank you, Mrs. Future. We need a little download on that. More closer to home, Venus is in the news.
There you go. All right. From the farthest star to the nearest star.
This is our closest neighbor.
Call Venus the morning star.
Yeah. Yeah, the morning star.
She rivals the sun.
She does. She does. And you know what's interesting about Venus is that she's the same size as we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if Venus was actually inhabitable, we could be happy there because in terms of the gravity, we'd be used to the similar gravity, which
sure,
would be
good. Sure, it'd be like summer all the time, right? Because
well,
it's so much closer to the sun.
Other than the 700-degree temperatures and the sulfuric acid in the atmosphere, it's perfectly habitable.
Yeah, we'd have to probably do something about that.
We would. Meanwhile, our scientists have noticed that there is a very complicated atmosphere there with many layers to it, many layers to the atmosphere. And some of the layers actually could support microbial life as we know it. Like they have water in them, they have oxygen, they have something that our extremophiles might like on Earth. So they're thinking that maybe there might be some life there already.
Some little cloud beings.
The evidence is that they see these clouds creating these dark and mottled effects regularly. They thought there was just an atmospheric aberration, but it's following patterns that we've seen in biology, similar to what we call
the algae blooms,
exactly. The mm-hmm. algae blooms. It looks like algae blooms in the atmosphere of Venus.
All right. So we're starting to build up our hopes that maybe there is life on Venus. We don't have to go all the way to Mars.
It depends on the kind of person you are. Now, a lot of scientists would say, oh, yes, let's see if there's anything there. And they'll go and maybe will be disappointed. But it's other people have the attitude that, well, hey, if it's a perfect place for life, why don't we put some there?
Oh, that's a real Dr. Future invention there.
Well, no,
hey, it's... clouds on Venus. That's the perfect place to spray some microbes.
Yeah, it's not scientifically correct, I guess. Well, I wouldn't say it. It's technically correct.
You are violating the prime directive, Dr. Future.
But morally
thinking
is the question.
Like that.
Yeah. I suppose so. But at the same time, if you take the position of Mother Nature here on this planet, you'd want to spread your seed far and wide. And this is just one planet, as far as you're concerned. And you'd keep going. It seems to me. I don't know. And maybe that's just me.
All right. When we get to Venus, should we leave some traces or leave no trace?
If it's empty. I'd say if it's empty. If there's no life there, we could put something.
Gotta go to a break.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Yes, I had mentioned to Charlie in the last segment of his show about how this is the 50th anniversary of 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Oh, the remember first that film? Movie I ever saw in a theater.
Really?
Yes.
Well, you saw television before that?
Yes, before that it was all television for me. And that theater that I saw it in was a brand new theater at the time. And it was one of those dome theaters, like the ones down in
Century 21.
Yeah, uh-huh. I was living in Nevada at the time, but yeah. So I saw that movie in a dome theater, and that probably initiated me for this day in Dr. Future
for
history.
That, yeah. Do you guys have any 2001 experiences? Ryan's our guest, our mystery guest, coming on the second hour of the
Were
show.
Were you affected by Kubrick, by 2001?
Well, I still remember that obelisk as this numinous object somewhere in my psyche that's trying to tell me something and I don't understand it.
Kind of looks like the United Nations, you know, the shape of the building. It's sort of funny. We actually took some scenes from that film and re-edited it a few years ago for a Santa Cruz celebration, a big party, and we projected our re-edit on the clock tower downtown.
Yeah, do you remember first night in 2001? So we were working with a group of people to put together the visual.
Yeah, that's right. The year
from 2000 became 2001.
And 2001, A Space Odyssey had special significance.
At the clock tower.
That's right. We were down there at the clock tower with the first night crowd.
And Dr. Pat Flanagan there with his lasers.
That's right. And we produced the history of civilization in the last 10 minutes of the countdown.
So. Yeah, we had to present civilization.
We had a lot of time, but it was a lot of history to cover.
Yeah, you're right.
But we did start it, I think, with the throwing of the bone
from 2001.
Right. And the becoming of the obelisk. That was definitely one of the big moments that
I should dig that up and put
show.
It on the website, you know?
It
was pretty epic. You stop and think about it, because you throw the bone. In 2001...
Were you guys there?
We were.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you remember it? Yeah, we do.
Do you remember the scene in 2001 where the monkey had discovered how he could use a bone as a weapon, and they started beating up other tribes, and then they felt triumphant, and they held the bone up in the air as a proud monkey, then threw it in the air, and it rotated over end, and turning
into a... Right, it was the first big transition in civilization from the movie's point of view, of when the tool-making monkeys discovered violence, that a tool could be a weapon. And then he throws it up in the air in victory, and then it spins and it becomes the first orbiting satellite.
Orbiting space cannon.
A space cannon.
Yes.
Yes, it becomes, well, I'm calling it a satellite.
Yeah, that's true too.
Yeah.
But to be more specific, because it continued the weapon motif. But I thought it would be interesting if we just reinterpret it a little bit and throw the bone in the air and see the whole evolution of the species from the caveman to modern man in one fell swoop.
Yeah, connecting the dots there, you know, from monkey to spaceship.
Yeah. But as I told Charlie, it came out the same year as Planet of the Apes. Remember that film with Charlton Heston?
Oh, good year for apes in Hollywood, huh?
Yeah, and oh, by the way, the great triumvirate of that was Barbarella. Barbarella was the third film that
about the human
came out
monkeys.
That year.
And as a different kind of monkey.
Young teenager, I must say, they all got my attention, especially Barbarella in that.
Pretty unforgettable.
Yeah, yeah. Realistically, though, Planet of the Apes, and I thought that 2001 was an even greater film. And it really set the stage for the future, the understanding of the ending, as, despite what most people thought, as actually brilliant, and really took us to a whole new level of understanding the future of the species. That said, I think that those other two films were equally brilliant in their own ways.
Mm-hmm. That first film you were talking about was Barbarella, or was
it 2001? No, the 2001, Barbarella, and the third, the triumvirate, was the Planet of the Apes, 1968. Other people were at Berkeley, SDS, Vietnam. No, I was at those films and enjoying them on the big screen in Philadelphia.
Yes, well, very evolutionary times. And that, of course, 2001 is so formative. So many filmmakers were influenced by that.
We have a great link of various filmmakers who have reflected on this film over the years and talked about how it was significant to them.
Say Nick in Royal Oaks would like to make a comment about 2001 and Elon Musk and space.
Sure.
At a moment.
Sure.
All right. Let's say hi. Hi. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Thanks.
Hey, Nick.
You know, I get to thinking, you know, with the description of mankind you send in outer space, maybe give them a frozen embryo, a few sets, and put on if you, should you dare. Please take attitude, adjustment of atmosphere, and you might come out well. How are you? You know, Jupiter's rising under the moon this morning?
Oh.
Or under the moon yesterday?
No, I didn't notice that, but thanks for pointing that out. I'll take a look. I was looking at the moon this morning. It was beautiful.
Yeah, I suppose it'll be on top of the moon. It was a northeast side under, so we'll see where it is tonight.
Oh, cool.
It'll be clear. Elon Musk, I wanted to bring up.
Okay.
What size foot? I would guess him as a 13.5.
Well, I couldn't tell you that myself, but...
Do we really need 2,000 more launches to get a wide band? Do we have to have that?
It'll change everything. Listen, you know, you have no idea what bandwidth will do to the entire species really fast. It's a nervous system. It'll make everything else obsolete very quickly. The existing system will go away. You want to talk about evolutionary change? That's the level you have to think about it, on a planetary scale. You know, thinking of the borders and all this stuff is primitive thinking.
All right. We do have another couple of callers, Nick, so I want to just thank you for your call. And
not there.
What?
Yeah. I would embrace more of a biological metaphor for understanding it. Okay. And as such, you'll see it as a nervous system, and a greater nervous system for the species will lead to phenomenal evolution in our consciousness. It'll be like a true renaissance, like the Middle Ages wanted to be.
Great. So you feel like inventors are part of the planetary consciousness, and they're helping the planet as an intelligent
Well, the wizards are driving it. It's interesting.
Extend her reach to space.
I think so. I think the true wizards are tuned in with nature and are creating inventions based on a lot of the principles of nature and applying that in terms of our species technology. They're really tuned in. And at the same time, a lot of our scientists are missing other aspects of, I hate to use words like autism, but there's everybody has their specialty, and it focuses your attention in the realms that you're good at, and you miss other things. And that's why you need a community to really understand. So the wizards need people, leaders that understand other aspects of reality, like
empath.
The emotional literacy, for example.
Sure, we need emotional
and things
literacy.
Like that. But collectively, it's truly amazing. Okay, go ahead.
Well, we have another caller. Dave and Salinas wants to say something about 2001.
Yeah, all right.
Hi, Dave. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Dave.
Yes, good afternoon, folks. It's been a long time since I've seen that movie, but I was always under the impression that the apes were fighting each other, and one clobbered the ape, and he was happy that he did it, and he swooped his bone down on a pile of bones, and that one bone flicked up into the air, and that's the one you saw fly. I don't ever remember him throwing it.
Wait a minute here. You're changing my whole mythology before my very eyes. If you're right, then I would be amazed.
Wasn't it the apes that were getting beat
no,
up
they threw
suddenly
it.
Became the dominant apes?
There is a
scene. There was a message about weaponizing the gifts of nature there.
Yeah, you knew that they were going to progress into a warmongering group of society people.
No, it's just that aspect of humanity was we got it. We got how tools could create a dominance over others.
Anyway, yeah, it is kind of a law of the jungle, law of nature, and it's not just humans.
Deeply encoded, probably goes back even before the apes, actually.
And yet, I would say civilization proves that it's not the most dominant behavior. It's just one among many, and that we've succeeded in civilization as much as we have because we've been able to tame the bullies and come up with different kinds of power that obsolete...
Yeah, jails.
That kind of
yeah, for example.
Yeah,
civilized.
Well, morality, how about that?
Yeah, another thing kind of have a pet peeve about, it's like, we have a perfectly good planet here.
Yeah.
Why do we have to fight so hard and go look for another one that's not even going to be able to sustain our life without really working ultra hard and living underground? And I mean, we got beautiful forests and rivers.
Yeah. Well, you make a good point there.
Hey, there's something for everybody.
And this planet, to be able to just create this as a... and recognize it for the amazing place that it is truly an important first step. I agree. And as you realize how wonderful it is here, you can see how incredible it is in the solar system. Not in the same way, but...
I can see going out there for minerals. We could make metals that we can't make here because we're getting different types of irons and ores from either planets or asteroids. We'll probably come up with some incredible metals.
Well, you understand, like, there's, if you think of it purely in terms of our species, which we mostly do, and you think the asteroid belt would be a giant Home Depot, it's got everything there. Ceres, for example, the dwarf planet in the asteroid belt, has almost, if not more, water than the Earth, just sitting there, frozen.
That's incredible.
Right? And imagine dropping that on Mars. A little geoengineering, and before long, you have, you know, really nice planets that, not dead ones.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah,
it really...
think of it as new homestead land.
Yeah, I mean, we have an amazing capacity as a species to do stuff like that, once we have the will or the desire, really. But I'm saying the possibilities, and the wizards could make this happen. It's really depending on what we want to do.
Depends on how far advanced we make our minds.
Yes, and how far can we take it?
Hey, the sky's the limit.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for the
call. All right, guys.
Bye.
All right. It's amazing what we can think of. I'm always amazed at the possibilities. The best ones are possibly the ones that we could actually make real. And I think going towards a solar system thinking, a solar system economy, only makes sense.
All right, Dr. Future. We're going to be back after a couple minutes with Ben Fuchs. Stay tuned for more Dr. Future Show after this.
Love that.
Oh my God, I had eaten something I shouldn't from the all-you-can-eat hotel buffet. My all-you-can-eat was quickly and violently wanting out. To understand the primal nature of digestive distress, it's important to understand the nature of something called the digestive brain. The digestive tract is in many ways like an independent animal that lives in our bodies. It has its own musculature and blood supply and immune system, and this digestive brain runs pretty much the whole digestive show. Even without stimulation of the central nervous system and the brain in the skull, many of the digestive processes will occur uninterrupted. Like the brain in our heads, the digestive brain depends on nerve chemicals called neurotransmitters to do its work. Chief among these biochemicals is the substance serotonin. Typically regarded as a type of happy hormone, serotonin is more accurately thought of as an alertness and emergency management hormone, and 95% of it is used by the digestive brain. Serotonin is charged with eliminating toxins from the digestive system. It shuts down the appetite. It slows down digestive juices. It stimulates elimination and evacuation of digestive contents through nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. Even the digestive discomfort of morning sickness may have a serotonin connection. These digestive effects have been exploited by drug companies looking for new markets for serotonin drugs. While supposedly only approved for mental health issues, these medications are being used for their appetite suppressant effects, and drug companies are studying their properties in their continuous search for anti-obesity pharmaceuticals.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Now, another approach to think about space and our solar system would be to be less species-centric about colonization of the solar system. Instead of just thinking about us, you know, which is important, of course. We always think about us, usually me. Most people, I think the science has shown that 90% of our thoughts are about the self and 10% are about others, typically. Collectively, we mostly think about our species, but actually there are a trillion species here, a trillion species on Earth, and we mostly don't think about them as much as us. most of the time. Look at the news. And what are we hearing right now? Another big shooting, this time at YouTube. Nasty. You know, things like that are very much species-centric, as they should be. But there are lots of other species here. And so another way to think about colonization of space would be to think about how other life forms on this planet would handle other ecosystems in the solar system. Venus, an atmosphere in a certain strata of the clouds in Venus could actually support microbial life as we know it on Earth.
So you're going to start interviewing the microbes here on Earth and see who would like a hitchhiker's ride to the galaxy?
I think it makes perfect sense to think about what microbes here would love to be there and help them migrate. Our role as a species is to help other
think
species
of it as
migrate.
Companion planting on our next-door neighbor planet.
Yeah, and especially if it's empty. You know, that's one way to think about it.
It'd have to be pretty hardy species to get from here to there.
We have
and then
amazing
survive.
Extremophiles on this planet. Amazing extremophiles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so atmospheres on Venus would be perfect for them.
Well, those are stories of heroism that deserve to be told.
Yeah, the ones that live near volcanic vents, for example. They like sulfuric acid, things like various extremophiles that we would not like. That's why we can't be species-centric in our thinking to see what would be appropriate for other
species.
Well,
we might accidentally do some good for the other species without even intending
it. Well, you would. Yeah, we do. We do that, and like because of our decontamination issues with our spaceships, lots of microbes have survived and are now in the belly of our spacecraft on Mars, for example. They're alive, and so we actually have already achieved this, and unknowingly, you know,
because unintentionally,
or as much as possible. We've tried to sterilize our craft. The scientifically appropriate approach is to completely sterilize our spacecraft and not let any bugs from this planet get on the others for fear of contaminating.
Yeah, we definitely want Mars to respect us in our casual dates with them.
Yeah, yeah. And so we've tried to do that, but have not been 100% successful in that. And who knows what the Russians have done? I mean, maybe we do. But there's a lot of bugs over there on Mars that we've sent, and that's already contaminated.
You're saying it's just par for the course?
Well,
it goes
with the
territory?
Well, we think about it. Like, for example, we're going to send probably a submarine to one of the moons of Jupiter, I believe.
Right. Was it Titan?
Titan's one of the worlds, but there's one, Enceladus, I think. Enceladus is a water moon, and it's got an ocean. So we're going to send a submarine there to explore that. And that definitely is being sterilized. Because if this is like the water in Enceladus, you think of it like the water underneath the Antarctic ice. It's pristine, pure. Nothing's touched
it. As far as we know.
As far as we know, from here. Until us. We don't want to ruin it. But what if we find that it's perfectly pristine water and there's no life there? Then I think it's possible to maybe introduce it. If you're an agent of life itself, not just our species, but of the biosphere, then you'd see how you could spread through the universe. And that would be how you do it.
There you go.
Yeah.
Nature talking through your face.
But first we see if it's inhabited already. You know, what's there? And then analyze that. Look at or talk to it. Right, or communicate with it in some way. And look at to see what kind of molecules, are they alive? If so, then are they, what's their DNA? Is it the same as ours? Look at origin structures there. All life in this solar system probably came from the same source, but maybe not. But we'd go into more detail about it from there. So, yeah. Boy, oh boy. So Mars, already we've pollinated.
With
other
some
species.
Some people say contaminated. You like to say pollinated. I'll go with pollinated.
Pollinated, yeah. Take more of a nature approach. You see what I mean?
Yes.
On that front.
Yes. Pollen is what flowers do to create fruit.
Exactly. Yeah. Future really doesn't lie in moving our bodies to these locations. The bodies that we have on this planet.
Just our microbes.
No.
Okay. So we can take some of our body parts?
Well, we could. Okay.
Maybe most of them.
Look how much of a pain in the butt it is to get a body to the space station even. That's only a couple hundred miles away.
Yeah.
And huge amounts of money. It's ridiculously expensive.
Oh, and then keeping an Earth body there for even a few weeks does all kinds of damage to your bone density.
Our twin astronauts, the poor bastard, had to come back to the Earth and was suffering miserably from gravity for months and months and has changed. I really feel for him, you know? Mm-hmm. I would not want to have to put up with that, but I would love to be able to experience zero gravity in space and have fun and enjoy the benefits of being in space.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, it's just if we're going to take our bodies to space, we have to take our gravity with us. We have to take all of the things that make our bodies function with us.
We
have to take our water, our air, our food, our elimination stations. We have to have all those things that allow us to live here with us when we go.
Yeah, we need our whole ecosystem or some kind of ecosystem that supports us with it. Consider this. Consider the possibility that you could leave your body here and you could travel with your consciousness, your mind, to other places and be there and feel like you're there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why
dreaming is the best way to travel, right?
That's why, Mrs. Future, we play so extensively with virtual reality. And on the other side of the coin here, lucid dreaming.
Uh-huh.
Right? And perhaps the two of those together can get us into some very interesting places in this universe.
That's right.
Yeah.
We're going to stimulate those senses and we're going to send out those sensors. In the middle, we'll have brand new experiences of faraway places.
Yeah. One of the main things that NASA has been adding to this equation is the remote sensing of things through telemetry, through teleoperation of equipment, where you are on Earth and you're operating, say, the Canada arm on the space station,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you have a long distance control. And it's not just muscular control, it's awareness of your other senses, your eyes, your hearing, where you feel like you're somewhere else.
Well, this is back to Ready Player One, which really is a state-of-the-art movie about that technology and where it can take us.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of great scenes for showing you VR. They showed a lot of these ideas that we talk about on the show, so we definitely suggest you get there. Ready Player One is a great example of VR, AR ideas. I think that the element that NASA introduces, though, is the liveness of being elsewhere in this universe.
Mm-hmm.
Like the guys who do the Martian landers.
Yeah, Curiosity and Opportunity.
Right, they move them around. Mm-hmm. They get to look through their eyes on Mars every day. They're there for hours. They see the red planet as they cruise around. They have stereo, big stereo cameras at 5 feet up in the air, which is in a height that we're like, you know, for our species. And at the end of the day, I think Bruce Damer was asking them, you know, what's it like? And they said that it was like being there, literally being on Mars all day.
Yeah.
And more close to home, we have pilots that are running drones in the Middle East. And they feel like they are there
mm-hmm.
all day, even more so because there's no time delay. Mars is like 10 minutes for your signal.
Well, I think it's very appropriate that we've spent this first hour really thinking about the universe and our ability to experience that universe through inventing ways of extending our senses and mm-hmm. our consciousness. And I think it's really great that we're going to spend the next hour talking about things we can do in our bodies, things we can do right here locally with the genetic gifts that we've been given by our
So you're talking macrocosm, microcosm, Mrs. Future? You're taking,
well, I'm just saying,
you know,
there's the universe that's inside your mm-hmm. skull, and there's the universe that your skull is here to sense directly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good that they're connected through your body.
I agree. And we're going to take it all the way down to transportation and railroad tracks running north and south in this county. And my goodness, what can we do with them?
Right.
Where can we take the transportation of our own community to the next level?
All right, folks. When we come back, we're going to be talking about bike trails, and we're going to be talking about wheelchair bicycles, and we're going to be talking about the future of transportation with our guests, Karina McFarland
and Ryan Saratoro.
Sarnatano.
Yes.
Dr. Future, back after the traffic and weather at the top of the hour.
Yeah, see you then, folks.
We're on KSEO, Santa Cruz. See you in a few minutes.